How to catch a man that can leap over garden walls and run from rooftop to rooftop, no matter the distance between. They can't catch me, not even now with their new contraptions and machines, not with their modern wizardry. They will never catch Springheel Jack. Time will reclaim me.
That was a promotion for my new novel, The Return of Springheel Jack, coming out very soon, October 2012, I believe, is the projected date, by the fabulous Black Bedsheet Books. Cannot wait. And today we have author John Prescott, from, you know him from the novels of Prey and now Hell. It's kind of a short interview because I wanted just to get right to it. We have an exclusive treat here. John has read Chapter 3 of Hell, just for my beautiful listeners. So, thank you, John, and let's get right to it. Hey, good morning, everybody. We are here with John Prescott. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
And so you've got two books out now, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And they're Revelation Chronicles, yes.
Oh, okay. Now, the first one is... Sorry, my dogs. Now, the first one is Prey. What's the second one?
The second one is called Hell.
Wonderful. And what's this one about?
This tracks the merry band even further through the tribulation period as told in the book Revelation. And it's a pretty dark book. It's not a happy book by any means. I get to delve into like the prophecies and the minions of hell on Earth a lot more than I did with the first book.
So what, well, I think it's obvious what inspired you, but what made you decide to actually go there?
Well, I mean, it was just there, and it's part of the story I wanted to tell. And well, the first book, you know, is trying to get everybody together, you know, and, you know, trying to figure out what's going on. And now this time I get to get into the meat of the stuff, and everybody has their agendas and, you know, their little tasks that they have to do while the world's basically, you know, pretty much going to hell around them. So,
oh man.
But it's been fun, I'll have to say that. And I've already had people finish it already in like 2 days. So I'm like,
oh, wow.
You have to slow down this reading because I can't write that fast. But everybody's loved it. They said it's even better than the first book. So that was my biggest concern, really, is making it better than the first book, you know, because being a writer, you want each book, you know, your next book to be better than the one before it. So hopefully,
yeah,
I've succeeded. I like it the best out of them so far. But
do you have a favorite character?
Oh gosh, that's hard. I've been asked that a lot of times. I really can't say, because I mean, I love them all. But if and is it different times of the day? I have different characters. It's kind of hard to It's really hard to pinpoint a favorite character. And I guess I should say that in the past tense, because not all the characters make it through this book.
So,
like I said, it's not a nice book. So this
were
is
there,
more...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Were there scenes that you maybe didn't want to write but knew you had to? Like, you know, have you ever just come across a scene where it's too much for you to even get into, but it's a pivotal part of the story?
Well, it's really funny that you should ask that, because this book was finished around the end of summer last year, and something just kept nagging at me and saying, you know, you need to go back and read this, and I couldn't ever pinpoint what it was, and I finally... You know, after rereading it twice, I figured out what it is, and it's the death of a character, and it's how I had the character killed that was bothering me. So I swapped that around and changed that, and by me doing that, from that point on to the end of the book, everything changes. And I rewrote that last 150 to 200 pages four different times to get it to where I liked it. And I knew I had to do it because I thought it was, you know, it was better for the story. And I think intentionally that's what it was wanting to be. Anyway, but it was definitely a hard scene to write, and I really can't give that too much away because I haven't read it. But it's pretty brutal. That was probably my hardest scene to write in that book. So
that's always so interesting to hear other writers talk about that. When you kill off, or when one of your main characters dies, do you, as the writer, go through a mourning period?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm over halfway done with the third book, you know, that's going to end the trilogy, and I'm definitely missing them already. I kind of thought, oh, this would be a perfect part for this character, and it's like, no, can't do that.
Yeah.
And it's taught me a lot of stuff too by changing that in. I'm definitely not a plotter, or you know, to plot everything out. I tried doing that, you know, in my first rewrite of it, and that didn't work. And I'm not an outliner. I can't outline stuff, you know.
Right.
And after trying to combine, you know, doing each separate and combining the two, and I just said, the heck with this. So I just sat down with, opened up my laptop and just started writing from the gut, like I wrote the first book and the rest of the second book, and that's what I'm doing with the third. I'm not outlining anything, just going with it. So.
No, that's brilliant. I respect the writers that can do an outline. I'm not one of them like you. No. I just have to go for it. To me, that's part of the fun, though, because, you know, you're sitting there writing along, and you're just as surprised at the twists and turns the story's taking as the reader hopefully is.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm like, is that how that turns out? Well, okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So you say there's only going to be three in this series?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, not just only three. I'm sorry. But now, how long does it generally take you to maybe finish one whole novel?
It really depends on my like work schedule, because I do a little bit of everything. I have a full-time job, too. And then right now, it's full-time softball season. I umpire girls' fast-pitch softball. And that eats up a lot of my time, but I work nights, so it kind of eases up some of the stuff. But I probably wrote the second book, I would say, in probably 2 months' time.
Okay, that's really impressive.
Yeah, well, I write 4 hours every day, regardless. Sleep,
wow.
No sleep, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've just trained myself to do it, and it's really funny how trainable creatures we are once we put ourselves into a habit. And it's really weird, because if I don't start writing at that time, I start getting like it, you know, jittery, and say, okay, I should be doing this, you know. Just it's like that internal alarm bell going off saying you should be writing right now, so.
You know, that's just so funny that you mentioned that, because I just started doing that last week. There will be a time every day that I write. And I was so proud of myself, because I've done it for like 8 days in a row now.
Mm-hmm.
But I've only committed to 30 minutes, and you've committed to a whole 4 hours.
Yep.
I'm going to have to relook my schedule.
Well, I've got a little bit, you know, because I work nights, and it's pretty slow where I work. So I'm really fortunate, you know, with that. But before I was doing that, I'd wake up probably about 4 a.m, you know.
Yeah.
And write for 2 hours the way I get home, like 2 hours before I go to bed, I'd write for 2 hours. So.
No, that's impressive. Or I'm just a giant slacker.
Oh, no.
Or both.
No, a lot of people have that problem. You know, well, I don't have time to write, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I get a lot of people, you know, I want to write a book. How did you write that? I said, well, I sat my ass in the seat and I wrote it. Yeah, that's the only way it's going to get done.
That's exactly right. I mean, I hate to say it like this, but you have to treat it like a chore.
You do.
Yeah.
You do.
Now, who published this one?
I self-published it.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And has that been a good experience for you?
Oh, yeah. It really has. I've probably, I think between, see, I sold ebooks and the physical books, softback and hardback version. I did a big pre-order sale, and I threw in a, for those who pre-order, they're getting a big 12-inch by 19-inch art print that was done specifically for this book, and it depicts a scene from the book that they get for free. That for those who pre-order the book, it's up on my Facebook page. You can see it. It's plastered everywhere. So I like it. But.
So that's at Facebook, John Prescott, Prescott.
Yep, that's right.
For those that can't spell like me. Now, was there any one decision that made you decide go self-publishing?
I just want, because I self-published my first book of short stories, and I did really well with that. And I did a collection called Emma's for Monster, and I self-published that, and that was done with all just authors that I know here on Facebook, and I self-published that. So I'm pretty well, you know, I know what I'm doing. So
it sounds like it. Yeah, it sounds like you're having great success with it.
Yep.
Success. Perfect.
So far, and I've got another collection that I'm doing. Me and my ideas. It's called Dreaming Dreaming in Darkness. It's a Lovecraft theme collection. It's going to be four novellas. By me, Adrian Chamberlain, Aaron J. French, and Jonathan Green, and they're all Facebook author buddies of mine, and I'm heading that little bad boy up, and it seems to get a lot of response already, and I'm looking forward to that, and I'm adding a little bit something different too. I miss, like, the older books. Well, some of the books have them now, except like your big name publisher, you know, like the interior illustrations, you know.
Yeah.
I'm having the guy who did my art print for the pre-orders for Hell. He's going to do a piece of artwork for each one of the four different stories that's in the collection. So I'm going to add that in and see how that goes over.
Ooh, that sounds awesome.
So But it's on Facebook too. It's called Dreaming in Darkness. The cover art's already up for it. It's pretty awesome looking, I think. So.
That sounds so cool. Are you going to be at a New Orleans World Horror Convention?
Yep.
2013.
Yeah. Sure am.
Cool. I'll see you there.
I only live like an hour and 15 minutes away from New Orleans, so.
Oh, right on. Are you going to have a table, do you think?
Yeah, I probably will.
That's so awesome. Well, cool. I'll get to meet you there then.
Yep. I will be there.
Is there any other contact information you'd like to give?
You can just let me on Facebook. My website is still under construction. Them stupid websites, I swear. And I'm going to be incorporating my own blog into it now. And, you know, there'll be a blog and the website all in one. And or you can just find me on Facebook. That's usually the quickest way to find me. I'm in a lot of groups and stuff like that. So.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to go right into your chapter, which I can't wait to read.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. I enjoyed it.
John Prescott. Chapter 3. The stark glow of computer screens lit the room with their signature ambient lighting, and the low hum of hard drives provided the soundtrack as fingers danced across keyboards. Lindsay had been staring at the bank of monitors for 6 hours, and she still couldn't believe what she was seeing, or look away from the video news footage. Every broadcast sent new waves of terror through her. Hell had, indeed, come to Earth. Eric sat close by, one hand resting on the arm of her chair, ready to calm her. He'd come running when he heard her scream, and they all huddled around to watch together as Apollyon took to the skies. Seconds after the demon's terrifying birth from the ground, Roxy went into labor, and the group scattered. So Lindsay sat glued to the computers while Eric read a technical journal, and Jean, almost a ghost to her on the other side of the dim-lit room, typed fast and clean to get out the world's latest news updates. Around the web, thousands who were fighting the same cause tuned in to see the most reasons why. "You almost done, Jean?" Lindsay asked. The clicking and clacking of the keyboard paused for a moment. 10 more minutes, then she's all yours. And off he went again. Click, click, clack, click, click, clack, click, click. They worked well as a team. The control room had been Gene's idea. Rick helped with the layout, and the core group gave it a unanimous blessing. It might have been considered an elaborate setup in the old days, but they had the cash for it now. Jessett still had connections, and he knew people who still wanted to deal only in money. For this little group, that was the least valuable commodity these days. Divided into five areas, the room contained a main area boasting a wall of 20 high-def touchscreens, always on and always monitored. These hooked into the major network feeds. A second area contained the group's archives, where past news footage could be replayed at will. Nestled in a far back corner, a third area housed Gene's and Lindsay's personal offices, side by side and equipped with the state-of-the-art communications technology. A fourth area held a conference table with laptops as place settings, serving as an alternate meeting space for the core group in case someone else was using the facility's main conference room. The fifth area, the smallest of the five, contained three computers separated from the rest of the room by an official partition. These machines stored the Book of Revelation in all its annotated glory, and this area was available to anyone who wanted to study up on events to come or prophecies that already had been fulfilled. This was Lindsay's space, although she shared it with Gene. Here was the place Lindsay could call home, where she could benefit the group to the best of her unique abilities. She glanced at Eric, who dozed in his chair. They were both exhausted, but Lindsay couldn't even fathom the notion of sleep, so she kept watch, reviewing the footage again and again while she waited for Gene's news report. It was almost comical, until the blood began to flow. People scattered in the streets like mad puppets granted partial brains. They ducked and ran, fleeing from nothing. Time after time, on one monitor after another, Lindsay saw screaming faces and flailing arms as crowds dodged unseen adversaries. Then, invisible claws laid lacerations across flesh. Crimson rivers flowed from torn skin. People who should be dead, who should be motionless bodies in the streets, instead remained alive. Some staggering, some running blind with blood running freshets from countless wounds. Agony stretched dozens of faces. Lindsay watched. The words escaped her, almost silent. And death will flee from them. She couldn't run. The pain, the torment was too much for them. They clawed at their own skin like rabid dogs after fleas. Screams issued from their mouths and silence from the muted monitors, and Lindsay stared as crowds writhed in tangles on the ground. On one screen, the man behind the filming of the horrific scene dropped his camera. The angle skewed skyward. Lindsay saw people jumping from tall buildings. Some flailed and fought away at unseen things. Others tore at their own skin as they plummeted to their deaths. But they did not die. On another screen, others ran wild into the streets in a fit to rid themselves of the unseen attackers, throwing themselves in front of erratic, panicked traffic. Steel impacted flesh. Bodies hit the pavement. Still, they did not die. Dozens got up again. Exposed skin now resembling bloody hamburger, still screaming, still fleeing aimlessly. Some were too broken to gain their feet, so they crawled instead, and those sent shudders up Lindsay's spine. Human bodies, prostrate and inching forward, dragging themselves by bloody, splintered fingernails. Still on another screen, and she looked upon another dozen who'd lost limbs after flinging themselves under a train, anything to end their suffering, and who now writhed on the tracks, truncated and helpless. Appendages ended in scarlet messes of meat, but no fresh blood flowed from those wounds. They could not die. Death fled from them. There were those, too, who seemed immune to the unseen assailants. Not everyone on the screens danced around like mad, and Lindsay saw the symbol on those, floating just inches above off their foreheads. But they didn't offer to help the poor souls around them. They just departed the scene, leaving the blood-soaked victims in the streets behind them. When the footage stopped on one monitor, Lindsay restarted it. She stared. On screen, a lazy blue sky went flaming orange. Tall spires of some unknown city jutted upward like metallic teeth. Then came the dragon. The massive reptilian body, engulfed in flames, rocketed across the sky. In its wake, enormous clouds of moving blackness followed. In the streets below, people stopped and stared, then began running and screaming as the black clouds fell upon the city. The dragon circled the buildings with a roar of rage and triumph, leaving a trail of fire that spread across the sky and consumed the heavens. Lindsay had no idea how many times she'd watched this terrible sight since they'd all stood together, taking in the live footage for the first time in real time. She remembered the gasp of shock and horror, the sounds of weeping for those faraway victims. It was Eris who named the Beast of Fire, and Trezd who named the black clouds before they vanished to claim other cities, towns, and rural areas full of the world's non-believers. Then how Roxy had screamed, childbirth introducing itself at the most inconceivable moment. So the group had scattered, and only Jean and Eric remained in the control room with her. Together, silent, the three watched as mankind fell. The Beast of Fire, the thing Eris called Apollyon, left little standing in its wake. Tracked by panic, spreading news coverage in all the languages of the world, the vast creature spread fire and destruction, leaving the scourge around the globe in a matter of hours. But the dragon left Jerusalem unscathed. Lindsay glanced at Eric, still dozing, then across the room at Jean, still typing away in frenzy. She needed to bring that detail to Trezd. But when?